I am very pleased that Terry Prince has been able to get back into the studio. We are using the studio again occasionally. And he's come in because we're going to discuss an author that both of us like very much, John Le Carré. We've both read a lot of his work and we've enjoyed a lot of his work in different ways. There have been quite a few films that I think we've seen as well. Very interesting past this man has, John Le Carré. Tell us a bit about him.
I did read, actually, his biography, most of which, of course, I've forgotten, as one does at my age. But fortunately, the book we're talking about now, A Perfect Spy, is in fact the most autobiographical of his novels. And in that way, you learn a lot, principally about his relationship, not just with the Secret Service, MI5, with whom he worked briefly, but paramountly his relationship with his father. His father appears in the novel as Rick. Rick is a con artist. He is, to be kind, economical with the truth. He's a swindler. He's served time in jail. He's totally unreliable, but he's charismatic. And he surrounds himself with people who adore him, including, in the novel, his son. And I think you'll learn a lot about Le Carré from that point of view. But what I liked about it, again, Rob, is it's not a George Smiley novel. And you and I have probably read all the George Smiley novels, from The Spy Who Came In Through the Cold, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, right the way through that particular sort of opus. But this one steps outside that and gives us as the lead character Magnus Pym. For Magnus Pym, think John Le Carré.
Now, he opens the novel with Magnus Pym off somewhere. Let's see what he's up to.
In the small hours of a blustery October morning in a South Devon coastal town that seemed to have been deserted by its inhabitants, Magnus Pym got out of his elderly country taxi cab and, having paid the driver and waited till he had left, struck out across the church square. His destination was a terrace of ill-lit Victorian boarding houses with names like Bella Vista, The Commodore, and Eureka. In build, he was powerful but stately, a representative of something. His stride was agile, his body forward-sloping in the best tradition of the Anglo-Saxon administrative class. In the same attitude, whether static or in motion, Englishmen have hoisted flags over distant colonies, discovered the sources of great rivers, stood on the decks of sinking ships. He had been travelling in one way or another for 16 hours, but he wore no overcoat or hat. He carried a fat black briefcase of the official kind, and in the other hand a green Harrods bag. A strong sea wind lashed at his city suit, salt rain stung his eyes, balls of spume skimmed across his path. Pym ignored them. Reaching the porch of a house marked No Vacancies, he pressed the bell and waited, first for the outside light to go on, then for the chains to be unfastened from inside. While he waited, a church clock began striking 5. As if in answer to its summons, Pym turned on his heel and stared back at the square, at the graceless tower of the Baptist church posturing against the racing clouds, at the writhing monkey puzzle trees, pride of the ornamental gardens, at the empty bandstand, at the bus shelter, at the dark patches of the side streets, at the doorways one by one. "Why, Mr. Canterbury, it's you," an old lady's voice objected sharply as the door opened behind him. "You bad man. You caught the night sleeper again, I can tell. Why ever didn't you telephone?"
His name is Magnus Pym, but when the door opens, the lady says, "Mr. Canterbury."
Pitches us straight into the world of deception, doesn't it? So, as a reader, you say, or as a listener, why has he changed his name? What's he doing in this little B&B, this outpost? What's he doing there? Why does he look round all the time? And before he even gets to the house, he's looked at every doorway, every alleyway, he's checked everything out. This is obviously a man who has something to hide.
And when he got out of the taxi, he didn't go straight to where he was going. He waited till the taxi had gone so that the taxi driver couldn't see where he was going. All the spy's tricks.
And he quizzed his landlady straight away about what's happened to number 5. I thought that hadn't been sold and so on and so forth. So he's not missed a thing. So he's very wary. He's very much on the alert. And we ask ourselves, why? What's he done? So the novel then really is about the answer to that question. Why is he on the run? And it's just after his father's funeral as well, which we learn fairly soon, which adds another question. Why did he flee the funeral and go there? What's going on? There's nothing more alluring than a page turner. What's going on? What's going on? But what's interesting about this as well is it goes backwards and forwards in time. And so you have to keep alert when you're reading it, as you yourself said, or when you're hearing it. You know, well, where am I now? I thought we were, oh, we've gone back in time, have we? I see. In addition to that, we sometimes have a first-person narrative. So Magnus is telling us what he thinks and what he sees and how he views relationships. And then we'll switch to the authorial voice, Le Carré's kind of all-encompassing voice. So you're constantly being questioned about how you perceive things and how the characters perceive things. And that's the world of spying, I guess.
It is quite a difficult title to listen to as it is to read, because you need to keep a pace with it.
Yeah.
And it's one of the more difficult because it's quite lengthy.
Yeah.
And you really do need to pay attention. But if you like this genre, if you like this sort of a story, the spy story, it is a cracking good tale. Yeah. And you have to go with it all the way through thinking, I don't know where this is going to go.
Yeah.
And it goes backwards to his time as a spy. He was working for the British, and then he became a spy for the East. We're back in the
Czechoslovakia
time.
Czechoslovakia. He was a double agent. But, Rob, what helps me as a reader is that, and perhaps we should have said this before, Le Carré is a great stylist. It's clear, it's so observant, it's so perceptive. And his characterization, he will draw characters in a couple of sentences, you know, and you know these people and you get to know them, and that takes you into the story and keeps you going. We might cite, for example, his wife, Mary.
Because he's disappeared.
His bosses
want to know where on earth he is, because they don't know anything about this house in...
Absolutely not. And they're watching her. The MI5 guys at this stage, joined by the American Secret Service eventually, are watching Mary very, very closely.
I mean, they're almost living in her house. And when the phone rings...
Mary's hand shot out to take it, but Brotherhood was already grasping her wrist. Still holding her, he leant towards the door and yelled for Harry while the phone went on ringing. It was rising 4 a.m. already. Who the hell calls at 4 in the morning except Magnus? Inside her, Mary was praying so loud she hardly heard Brotherhood's shout. The phone kept calling her, and she knew now that nothing mattered except Magnus and her family. "It might be Tom," she shouted while she struggled. "Let go, damn you!" "It might be Lederer, too." Harry must have flown downstairs. She counted two more rings before he was standing in the doorway. "Trig this call," Brotherhood ordered, loud and slow. Harry vanished. Brotherhood released Mary's hand. "Make it very, very long, Mary. Spread it right out. You know how to play those games. Do it." She lifted the phone and said, "Pym residence." Nobody answered. Brotherhood was conducting her with his powerful hands, willing her, pressing her to talk. She heard a metallic ping and crammed her hand over the mouthpiece. "It could be a call code," she breathed. She held up one finger for one ping, then a second, then a third. It was a call code. They had used them in Berlin, 2 for this, 3 for that, private and prearranged between the Joe and base. She opened her eyes to Brotherhood to say, "What shall I do?" He shook his head to say, "I don't know either." "Speak," he mouthed. Mary drew a deep breath. "Hello, speak up, please." She took refuge in German. "This is the residence of Councillor Magnus Pym of the British Embassy. Who is that? Will you speak, please? Mr. Pym is not here at the moment. If you wish to leave a message, you may do so. Otherwise, please call later. Hello?"
Of course, one of the things you're not sure of is which side Mary's on, because Mary is obviously, I mean,
very good. That's true.
She is his wife. She knows an awful lot about him. They're not sure whether she knows where he is.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And so it goes on, and that's the trickery of spying. Yeah. Nobody can ever trust anybody else.
That's
the English
absolutely
don't
right.
trust the Americans. All these things going on all the time.
You're absolutely right. It's about being suspicious. It's about deception. It's about what aspect of yourself you choose to display at any time. It's also fairly brutal in its approach. I mean, Brotherhood, who leads the English group at trying to find out where he is, no punches spared. I mean, and doesn't hold back. And there's no sympathy for Mary. You know, she doesn't get it. She doesn't deserve it. They're after the truth. They're after to know how much damage Pym has done.
yes.
in his activity. It's giving nothing away to say he's a double agent. I mean, you know, it's not a secret in the book. It doesn't spoil the story to know that.
No, what we don't know is what's going to happen in the end. Yeah. We won't give that away, obviously. There is, about all spy novels, a sense of, well, not cruelty, but they have to be really serious. And if it means they have to kill somebody, they will. There's no question. People get murdered in spy novels because they're the wrong person, the wrong place. And in a lot of John le Carré's work, you have this sense that there are those in power, they've got this control. They are the sort of characters who would enjoy that power. Mm. And so you've got that level also. These are not all nice people.
No.
You don't know where Mary is, good or bad. You don't really know where Magnus Pym is. Is he a good guy or isn't he a good guy? Well, we know he's a double agent, but we learn more and more about him, and he has various friendships with different people.
The strong strand we mentioned at the beginning is the relationship between Magnus and his father, going right back to his school days. And then that, in a sense, is picked up when Magnus sends his own son, Tom, off to boarding school and writes letters to him and that kind of relationship. I mean, Magnus was a very different father than Rick was, but the father-son relationships form another thread through school and university.
Yes, our third and final extract is really picking up on this idea that the relationship between our, quote, hero villain Magnus and his father, Rick, is actually fairly central to the plot, as you've been describing, but you also would say it's central to the author.
I didn't read the autobiography, but those who reviewed it seem to say it gave nothing away, which doesn't surprise anybody. That came out very strongly, the kind of man his father was. And I think he was a bit more ambivalent about his own father than Magnus was in the book, who kind of adored his father, in spite of all his shenanigans in his way of behaving.
And as you say, one of the American agents or one of the troop of spy masters, whatever it is, has a theory, and he launches into this theory.
That's right.
Sir, you mentioned Pym's father, he bursts out, talking straight at Bramwell. Sir, I know about that father. I have a father who is not in certain ways dissimilar, only in degree. Mine's a small-time, iffy lawyer, and honesty is not his strong suit. No, sir. But that father of Pym's was a total crook, a con artist. Our psychiatrists have assembled a really disturbing profile of that man. Do you know that when Richard T. Pym was in New York, he faked a whole empire of bogus companies, borrowed money from the most unlikely people, really some important people, I mean listed. There's a serious strain of controlled instability here. We have a paper on this. He was overrunning himself but couldn't stop. I mean, Jesus, do you know? Magnus made the most wild pass at my own wife. I don't grudge him that. She's an attractive woman. What I mean is, the guy's everywhere. He's all over the place. That English cool of his is just veneer. Not for the first time, Lederer has just committed suicide. Nobody hears him. Nobody shouts. Wow, you don't say. And when Bramwell speaks, his voice is as cold as charity and as late in arriving. Yes, well, I always assume that businessmen are crooks, don't you, Harry? I'm sure we all do.
But the idea that all businessmen are crooks, I'm sure we all think that, don't we? It's a sort of a joke, isn't it? Which the English spy master is using against the American, but it's also one that John le Carré is using against his father. And
the many businesses that he attacks in his other books as well. You know, I think The Constant Gardener was about pharmaceuticals, something like that. I wonder if the listeners are thinking, well, you know, you've told us everything. But we haven't. The tension builds as you hear more and more about what they're doing to track down where Pym is and how Pym is having to keep alert to what's going on as well. And the other people who are going to get run over, as it were, metaphorically, as they relentlessly pursue him. Do they catch him? Well, obviously, we're not going to tell you that. What does he do as a response at the end of the novel? We're not going to tell you that either. But I think we're both going to say it's certainly worth hanging on in there to listen. And there's some humour in the book as well. just struck me that we mustn't make it sound as if it's all heavy, heavy.
Some of the characters, particularly those surrounding Rick, the father, the crooked father, are a hoot. I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
They're everything from prostitutes to thieves to whatever else, and they're just very funny in their own right.
That's right.
Very intriguing, and they're very well written, and that's one of the things you said.
That's right.
The quality of the writing, the quality of the understanding of the characters is superb.
Yeah.
He's a very, very well-experienced writer. Okay, I mean, he died very, very recently.
Yeah.
He's left behind a huge load of work. I was taken by the first book I read, which was, as I said, I saw the film of Richard Burton and...
The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. Terrific.
I hadn't read any of his stuff at that time. I immediately bought the book because there was one whole section in there where the head of the East German spy network was explaining... talking and discussing, and I didn't understand it, and I thought, I've got to read that again and again and again, and I have read it several times just to understand how these minds work and how that Cold War worked and what it was like then, and we're sort of going back into it again, the Cold War now, aren't we?
I think he's up there with the great British writers, quite frankly. He's earned his place in that pantheon of extremely good English writers.
I agree. Thank you very much, Terry.
My pleasure. It was a joy to go back and have a look at the book again and remind myself.
A Perfect Spy was written by John Le Carré. Our thanks to Calibre Audio for allowing us to use some extracts from this recording. The recording is by Patrick Purser, and the total running time is 21 hours. And thanks to Terry Prince for sharing his thoughts about A Perfect Spy.